a year ago, I mentioned that in the third century, 200 to 300, there were three great movements that were threatened for a time to become supreme instead of Christianity. Someone in that day would have had a hard time telling which of these four it would be. And the three movements which I named, included in my outline at that time, were Mithraism, Neoplatonism, and Manichaeanism. And I listed them so in the outline. And I think half of those who answered this question only mentioned one. I think nearly everybody remembered Mithraism. But the other two, and several, mentioned things from the second semester instead of the third. And since this was a definite part of the outline, I was disappointed that so many failed on that particular question. Well, now we are looking now at the English Reformation, and we have mentioned reasons why it is important to know something about it. And at the end of the hour, I gave you the dates of four English rulers who are so important in connection with the English Reformation that I would like you to recall the dates of these four rulers, definitely. And the first of them is Henry VIII. And under that, see the activities of Henry VIII. Number one is the character of Henry VIII. Henry VIII is a character that intrigues history writers and novel writers and even movie makers. He is, you will come across references to him over and over in different connections because he was a man whose character tremendously affected conditions in the time when he lived. I don't think he had anywhere near as great an effect on later conditions as some might think. I believe that many others had a far greater lasting effect. But in the immediate situation, his whims had a tremendous effect. And this is a very vital time in the history of Christianity because of the Reformation being in process of spreading out from Wittenberg and from Geneva, and the question of whether England would be taken over by the Reformation or would become a strong enemy to it was an important question for all future events. Now, it might be that if Henry VIII had not lived at all, or if conditions had been very different, that the Reformation would in the end have proceeded about as it did in England. That no one can predict, or no one can say with certainty. But the fact is that in the course of events there, the character of Henry VIII and his various activities made it easy or difficult for the Reformation and affected situations in a way that is at least a very interesting thing as one sees how history goes and how human life progresses. Whether its importance in the actual events is quite as great as people are apt to suppose. Now, the character of Henry VIII is, of course, important because of the particular position in which he was. That is to say, his father, Henry VII, didn't have anything like the effect on people that Henry VIII did, because, after all, Henry VII was not a legitimate ruler. He had a very flimsy claim to the crown. He had won a battle at Bosworth Field in 1487 and became king after there'd been oscillation back and forth during many years before, and he had to meet a number of others in the next few years who rose up and tried to get themselves made king against him, and nobody was really sure he had any right to be king. Henry VIII is altogether different. He was the son of Henry VII, and since Henry VII had been king, nobody questioned but that Henry VIII had the right to become king. Then Henry VII took over a country that was weakened by the constant civil wars, and the government strength was nothing like what it ought to be if the government was to have real influence throughout the country. And Henry VII, someone said, from a dashing conqueror, he was changed into a bookkeeper. Well, that's what he seemed to people to be his last 20 years of reign. But it was what was necessary. He organized the country. He organized the taxation system. He economized. He got the government into a solid, good situation. Now, that's not very romantic. And nobody had any great interest in or zeal for Henry VII. But when Henry VIII took over, the country was in a good condition, which Henry VII had gotten it into. It was well organized, the government was in a good fiscal situation, there were quite capable officials all down the line, a man from quite a poor background, but a man of great ability, Henry VII had picked out in advance until he was almost the leading man in the government under Henry VII, but was not yet far along in life, that is, he was middle-aged or a little under, and Henry VIII had him to depend on for keeping things as they were. And then in addition to that, Henry VIII was not only a man whose right to be king was unquestioned and who had a situation where the government had great power, but in addition to that, he was a man of rare personal charm. He had the ability simply to charm people when he chose to. He had even though he perhaps executed without just reason as many people as any king in modern times anywhere has ever done, at least in any civilized country. And men who were his best friends when they would turn against him at various times were he simply turned against and executed with as little compunction as a person would kill a fly that settled on his knee. And all this was known, and yet Henry VIII remained extremely popular with most of the people. And even after his death, what his desire was as to who should rule afterwards was thought far more important than what some later king in the next generation or two would think about it. When he became king as a young man of 20 or a little under in 1509, Erasmus was told by the king's tutor, "The heavens laugh, the earth exults, all is full of milk and honey and nectar." This wonderful young man, who is a learned man, he was originally trained to go into the church because his older brother was supposed to be king, but his older brother was a very feeble young fellow in poor health who died when he was 16 years of age. Henry had already received an education way beyond what most kings ever received in those days, but in addition to that, he was a strong, healthy, athletic fellow who in the tournament could unseat almost anyone who would come against him. He felt that he was ready to meet most any man in a wrestling match in England, and he was sure he could defeat them. The chances are he could defeat three-fourths of them, and the other fourth had too much sense to defeat him and risk the harm that would bring to them. He was considered handsome, athletic, learned, generous, wise, and merciful. And he had one of his first acts as king was to go against his father's wishes. His father had made an arrangement in order to get some of the gold of America, to have the older brother marry the daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella. And so young Catherine, when she was 16 or 15, had come over to England to marry Arthur, the older brother of Henry. And they had had an official marriage ceremony. She had brought a large dowry, but young Henry, who was about 10 years old at the time, had taken her by the hand and led her up to into the place where the marriage ceremony was to be held. And she looked at this stalwart young lad, and she saw the weak, unhealthy boy she was marrying, who was himself a little younger than she was. She got a rather romantic feeling toward him, and he did toward her. But she married Arthur, and after less than a year of marriage, he died. And, of course, she should have been sent back to Spain, and the dowry sent back too, but Henry was too economical to risk losing the dowry, and so he said, "Why can't she marry Henry, who's only about 6 years younger than she is? Why can't she marry him, and we can keep the dowry?" Well, the trouble is, it was against the church law for a man to marry his brother's widow. And this was definitely against the church law and was considered to be against the biblical law. In Leviticus 20:21, they read, "If a man shall take his brother's wife, they shall be childless." But Pope Julius at this time was very glad to do anything he could to please the King of England, and he gave a special dispensation to allow Catherine, though she had been married to Arthur when she was 16 and he was 15 for a few months, to allow her to marry young Henry. And Henry VII felt he had saved the dowry. However, as time went on, Henry became more and more distrustful that this was a good thing. That is the fatherhood. And so, before his death, he is said to have told Henry, I don't think you should go through with this Spanish marriage. Send her back. But young Henry, as soon as his father died, took the bit in his teeth and went ahead to do what he felt he wanted to do. And he immediately went to see Catherine, who had been much impressed with him before, and they arranged to be married. And they had the dispensation from the Pope already. And so she became his wife. Then Henry knew that his miserly father had had two heads of the taxation system who had been very unpopular from the way they managed to squeeze all the money into the king's coffers they could out of the people. And so 4 days after his accession, he issued a proclamation asking anyone who had sustained any injury from the taxing business to send in a report to the king. And immediately they got all kinds of letters, and so the king simply ordered the two men to be beheaded. And that made him more popular. He was destroying the oppressors of his father's reign. Well, he was a man who seemed to be such a fine character as he began his reign to so many people, but it is very hard for anybody to have all the power that he had without it affecting his character. There were those by the end of his reign who thought of him as a bloodthirsty tyrant. I'm sure the people as a whole didn't, because he was so charming when he chose to be in so many ways that the bulk of the people were greatly devoted to him. But he did become more and more determined on his own way as his life went on. And most people are apt to when they have the power that he had under the circumstances. Not having to fight for it, he had received it legitimately according to the silly idea that a position goes from a father to a son. Today, we've nearly given up that idea. Today, we don't think, for instance, of a president of the United States son as succeeding. When Franklin D. Roosevelt was elected 4 times, and some people began to think he'll continue permanently as ruler and probably pass it on to his son, and that was the attitude some people began to get to him because of his tremendous power and control over the American government at the time. I'm sure there were many who thought, well, now surely his sons will carry on to some extent after him. As far as I know, his sons are all living today, but you just never hear of them. Well, I shouldn't say never. One of them was mayor of Miami Beach, I think, 2 or 3 years ago. One of them has been in Congress. When he was president, we used to hear of the scandals and frequent divorces of his sons a great deal. Even that doesn't make the papers a great deal anymore. It just doesn't occur to us to think that a man's power would necessarily go to his son. But in those days, all over, it was an idea that was just as set as anything could be, that a man's power goes inevitably to his son. The only thing similar we have today, perhaps, is the reverse of it. I heard the story told, I don't know whether it's true or not, but I heard the story told that in Hungary, not long ago, the son of a bank official, who was himself working in the bank, was told by the communist authorities that he must leave the bank and go and work at the coal mine. And he said, I'm trained for bank work. I'm not trained for working in the coal mine. Why should I do this? Well, they said, because you don't come from the proletariat. Your father was a bank official, and you, therefore, must not be allowed to have higher education or any chance to get ahead, this being a communist country. And the man said, yes, but he said, you're not interfering with my father. He's continuing his important place in the bank. And, oh, yes, they said, but he convinced us that his father was a mine worker. And so he can have these privileges. And of course, that is the reverse attitude that you have in communist countries today. But this idea that was so common then resulted in giving Henry VIII and a good many people during the next two centuries power that they really had no right to, according to our present ideas. But it accounts to some extent for the tremendous influence that Henry had. Now, in addition to that, though, Henry had a tremendous lot of judgment, and he would have been a great politician if he had lived in any other age. Although he did just about what he wanted at any time, he used all the established principles of government. Back in the days of King John in 1215, the nobles had forced him to sign the Magna Carta, which allowed him to have a group of nobles to meet and to have a certain amount of judgment in the laws of England. And this group had gradually enlarged until now they called it the Parliament. And this group, which was made up of some elected people, some hereditary and so on, this group now was considered to have a good deal of authority in England. Well, anything of importance that he wanted, Henry got the Parliament to pass. Very few people would dare speak against what he wanted. They wouldn't know why that was very healthy to do. But in most cases, the Parliament passed the measures, and he seemed to be leading rather than driving all through his reign. And this contributed to the power that Henry VIII had. As you notice, his sharp turns and changes during his reign at times, as they seem to us when we take 30 years and we contract them into a few minutes of discussion, it seems strange that someone could turn in such ways as he did. But all through it, he managed to keep the Parliament with him and taking the actions that he wanted, and people often feeling that they had done it themselves. This was what they had worked out. And, of course, they often went way beyond what he wanted. But he was able, in general, to get what he wanted done. Now, all this would mean that if Henry VIII had been a man with great vision and great ideas as to important things that should be done, he probably could have turned the nation in the direction he wanted and accomplished a tremendous lot. But as it happened, he didn't have any such idea. His principal desire seemed to have been, first, for his own glory and greatness, second, for his own pleasure. And these seemed to have been his main ideas, and his ideas changed enough as to what would conduce to these that actually he more or less counteracted what he'd do at one time by another. He wanted to make a great, be a great conqueror, a man of tremendous influence in Europe, in the continent. Well, he entered into different wars, fought different battles, got glory to himself, but sometimes he'd be on one side and sometimes another. And all he did was to spend a lot of money and lose some lives. And in his domestic affairs, even in the religious situation, he didn't have a definite policy. And so all this tremendous ability he had, and this tremendous power that he had, means sharp turns one way or another. But in the end, it's a question just how much it actually accomplished in the development of England or of the Church of England. Actually, as I've said many times already in this class, it was the men who studied Martin Luther's works. It was the men who had a great love for the Scripture. The men who risked their lives to make the Bible known. Some of them were ready to lose everything, and many did, in order to advance what they believed in. It was they who, in the end, as far as Henry's reign was concerned, won out. So that Henry VIII's activities are perhaps not as important as they're usually considered to be, but they're very interesting. And they were immediately important, that situation after situation. And I think it is worth our spending a certain amount of time looking at them, though not near as much as one might be tempted to because of the great interest that you come across so often in them. I've known of several novels published in recent years dealing with Henry VIII or one of his wives, often very, very interesting, some of them bestsellers. You don't know how much truth there is in them, but at least a good bit of it is factual, what they contain. But it shows the continuing interest in that period and in those people. Well, so much for one, the character of Henry VIII. Now, number two, Henry's early attitude to Martin Luther. That we already mentioned when we discussed Martin Luther. You remember that Henry wrote his book in defense of the seven sacraments. And in this book, he attacks Martin Luther, calling him by most terrible names, and declaring how this wickedness must be entirely stopped. He sent the book to a gold, copy of the book with gold covers to Pope Leo X, and Leo gave him the title Defender of the Faith, which all English monarchs up to the present have included in their titles as a result of this book that Henry VIII wrote. He was very much against Martin Luther at first, and when Martin Luther answered in kind, he then wrote to the leaders in Germany complaining about Martin Luther showing such wickedness, as to speak of a king in this way. But this is Henry's first attitude, and probably the attitude he would have continued through his reign if it were not for number three, the problem of the divorce. Henry had Luther's books collected in 1521, had his books collected and publicly burned before about 30,000 people, with the bishop speaking against Luther. They did their best to keep his books out of England, but it was pretty hard to, because England was so dependent on foreign trade. It was quite easy to import, to smuggle some of them in. But this problem of the divorce, number three. Now, this is a situation which is not quite so simple as some might think. We mentioned already how it came that Henry married Catherine. And it would seem that she was devoted to him, and that for a period of 15 years or so, he gave the impression of being about as devoted to her as almost any ruler in Europe at the time was to his wife, more than most of it. But she had six children born, of whom only one survived over a year. And she had a number of miscarriages in addition. The one who grew up was a girl, and the people of England, after what they'd gone through in the War of the Roses, were very anxious that there be a son of the king, of whose succession to the throne there would be no question. Now, Henry, fairly early in his reign, took a mistress whom he visited frequently, and she had a son born who was like Henry. Strong, stalwart, attractive boy. Henry brought him to court, gave him the title the Duke of Richmond, which had been his father's title before his father's title before he became King of England, and wished that he had been Catherine's son. But he had a big celebration making him Duke of Richmond, but you could see from the attitude of the people that they did not feel that an illegitimate son should be his successor. They talked of having him marry the Princess Mary, but she was 8 or 10 years older than he was, and of course they were half brother and sister anyway. That didn't seem very satisfactory to people. And as the years went on, and they had either miscarriages or children, children stillborn, or children who would live a few days and then die, Henry's conscience bothered him. And he said, it says in Leviticus, that if a man shall marry his brother's wife, they shall be childless. And he said, that's exactly what's happening. And this lowered his confidence in the Pope. Because after all, Julius had given him a special dispensation to marry his brother's widow. And she was childless this way. He said, it doesn't look as if the Pope's dispensation's worth as much as the Pope makes out that it is. And he said, well, can't a present Pope say the previous Pope was wrong, and that we had no right to marry? In fact, we never were married. And it's annulled because we had no right to under the law. Well, of course, that would lower confidence in the Pope's power if one Pope says it's right and the next says it's the previous one was entirely wrong. But I'm sure the Pope would have been glad to do it. to please Henry, if it were not for the fact that Catherine was the aunt of the Emperor Charles V. And the Emperor Charles V was the most powerful ruler in the world. And if anyone was going to crush Luther, it would probably be the Emperor Charles V. And the situation was that the Pope wanted to keep on the best possible terms with Henry, and he wanted to keep, he didn't dare to too greatly offend the Emperor Charles. And so the Pope just kept putting it off with excuses. Well, now, about this time, Henry had had this first mistress we mentioned, and then he had taken another mistress, one Mary Boleyn, a very attractive woman who seems to have been sincerely in love with him, and who was greatly upset when he got tired of her and simply told her that he had picked a man for her to marry, and he was through with her. And she was very upset about it, and her father was still more upset because her father said when she was the king's mistress, she should have been able to get a lot of money out of him and a lot of good things, and here she doesn't have anything to show for it at all. But Mary seems to have been genuinely interested in him. Well, and now Henry had noticed one of Catherine's ladies-in-waiting when he was attracted to her and inquired who she was and found she was Mary Boleyn's younger sister. Not nearly as pretty as Mary, but something about her attracted him, and he inquired who she was and found that she was Mary's younger sister and that she was one of the leading heirs to one of the leading dukedoms in England, was greatly interested in her. In fact, the two of them had definitely decided they were going to marry. He was, I think, 16 or 17. She was 15 or 16. And so Henry passed the word to his leading official to get word to this young fellow that he mustn't pay any more attention to her. And he broke that up, but the other man took the blame for it. And she never knew Henry had to do it. Yes, you had a question? Mary's the older sister. Anne is young. Yes. Well, Anne Boleyn was completely heartbroken when the heir to be the Duke of Northumberland was forced to quit paying any attention to her. And he was too. It seems to have upset both the lives pretty badly, but they never thought of blaming Henry for it. They blamed this minister of state who had done it. And she retired to her father's estate, and then Henry began visiting at the estate from time to time. And so when he sent the request to the Pope to give him the divorce, he also requested him that he give him permission, if he were divorced, if he were free, to marry Anne Boleyn, despite the fact that her sister had been his mistress, and the Pope gave him that permission. That didn't offend the emperor. He was glad to do that. But it was no good to Henry as long as he was considered still married to her. And the Pope didn't say he was still married to her. He just said, we'll have to look into it further. We'll have to have a commission to investigate. We'll have to examine these things. And there were all sorts of considerations that entered into it, such as the claim they had never really lived together as man and wife. And pretty hard to prove that number of years back anyway, but such claims were being made, and the Pope just postponed the thing. And so Henry gradually changed his attitude toward the Pope, and he began to think maybe this man Martin Luther isn't quite so bad as we thought he was after all. And then one day, Henry's leading men was visiting at a place where he came in contact with a young teacher in Cambridge University. And as he talked to this man, the man said to him, he said, why does the king have to get the Pope's opinion on this matter, get a statement from the Pope? He said, after all, he said, in matters like this, why doesn't he consult the universities and the leading scholars and get their opinion? And he said, anyway, he said, the king in England has always been supreme in England, in political and religious affairs, why does he need to defer to the Pope in these matters? Why can't he simply use his own authority, which the kings of England have always done to some extent? Well, this man, this bishop came back and told Henry what this Cambridge teacher had said, and Henry said, that man has got the right Saul by the ear. He said, I'd like to see him. So he ordered him to get in touch with him and have him come to the court and talk with him. And that leads us to number four, Thomas Cranmer. Thomas Cranmer. And if you find in Henry VIII a man who was skillful in getting his way, but had no particular real principle he was striving for and twisted from one way or another through his life, you have, in a way, a character somewhat parallel with Thomas Cranmer, in that he was, like Henry, a man who was able to twist and squirm through his life. But unlike Henry, his objective in life was not getting his way or securing his own pleasure, but accomplishing what he thought was right and was worthwhile. And so Thomas Cranmer is an example of a man who was ready to bend and submit on all sorts of things that he felt was non-essential, or even some he felt were getting on the edge of being essential, but always keeping his eye on his main idea, which was to have biblical teaching come to occupy a central position in England. And the result of this is that actually Cranmer has had far greater effect on lives and thought during the 300 years since that time than Henry VIII had. And even to this day, he has considerable direct influence because of what he wrote. The English Prayer Book, Prayer Book of the Church of England, is a very great work of literature. And it is a work which includes in its statements the great biblical doctrines, beautifully expressed. I've had the experience of being in a little town in New England on two successive Sundays and finding there were two churches in the town. One was a Baptist church and one was a Episcopalian church, and my guess was they were both modernist, but I wanted to go to a church on Sunday, and so the first Sunday I went to the Baptist church, and there I heard a thoroughly modernist sermon. You felt as if you had profaned the Sabbath going and listening to this sermon, and really would have preferred not to go to church at all, but there was nothing else. That was what you got from it, a little singing, and maybe a few verses of scripture read, and some anti-Christian preaching. That was all. So the next Sunday, I felt like staying home, but I said, I think I'll go try the other church. So we went to the Church of England, and we got a sermon that was just as bad as the sermon in the Baptist church. It was just a straight modernistic sermon. You got nothing for your soul from it. But in that church, before they had the sermon, they read passages of scripture and prayers arranged in a certain manner, bringing out certain ideas and so on, and even though half the people read the words off so fast, you couldn't hardly tell whether they paid attention to what the words meant or not. Hearing it for the first time, you couldn't help being impressed by the great amount of Christian truth that was beautifully expressed. And I think one who heard it often would have some effect if they'd let their mind pay any attention to the words read. And if the minister didn't succeed in completely counteracting it with his sermon, they would have implanted in their mind some of the great scriptural truths most beautifully expressed. And those were written by Thomas Cranmer. They represent years of thought and pondering over how to express in beautiful language the great central themes of Christianity, and to make services for the church that would drive these thoughts home to the hearts of the people, particularly if, of course, there should be a rector who would follow it up with a sermon that would drive the thoughts home. Yes, Mr. Brown?
You indicated that Thomas Cranmer wrote the prayer book for the church. Yeah. And has it been revised since?
There are revisions here and there, but there has there has been considerable movement for thoroughgoing revision, but I don't believe any thoroughgoing revision has yet been made. To the present, certainly a great deal of it would still be Thomas Cranmer's works. Now, Thomas Cranmer, they say, was a he was in a position there where if he had stood up and said, this is what I believe, right down the line, 1, 2, 3, give you 30 points, this is what I believe, this is what I stand for, he either would have been put off in a position where he'd have absolutely no influence, or he would have lost his head. But the remarkable thing is that through all the changes and twists of Henry VIII's policy, Cranmer was able to keep Henry VIII's favor. And he was able to retain a tremendously important place in the church, and in the end, to have a tremendous influence on the church. And it is a most amazing thing. Now, some of the things he did, some people find absolutely inexcusable. Others think that under the circumstances, they can be understood. But he had his eyes on his objective, and he certainly accomplished a tremendous lot for that objective through the years. Now, the king immediately asked Thomas Cranmer to devote himself entirely to the study of the problem of the divorce, and asked him to go to the universities of England and of the continent and talk to the people and get judgments from the leaders about it. But they found that most of the leaders felt, as Martin Luther did, that Henry, having been married for about between 15 and 20 years to Catherine, and this way, that there was no reason why he would have any right to divorce her, that she was his wife to whom he was obligated for life, unless she were to do something reprehensible, of which nobody ever suggested had been the case. And they felt that if it was necessary for the stability of England, that there be a male heir to the crown, and she couldn't produce one, it might be worth considering the possibility of having a second wife. But to push her out in this way, there was hardly anybody who would give any support to that idea. Cranmer traveled about on the continent, met the leaders. He had already before this time been convinced of Lutheran views. And in fact, while he was on the continent, now he married the niece of one of the Lutheran theologians in Germany. And he was strongly convinced of Lutheran views and anxious to advance them. He also believed in the supremacy of the king, as everyone in England did, and he was anxious to advance what the king desired. But they could not get an action from the Pope. The Pope just kept putting the thing off. He sent a representative to England who went through forms and investigated all kinds of historical questions and then said, as far as we can go, it must go back to Rome and all this. And meantime, Henry was becoming more and more anxious to have Anne Boleyn for him, and she refused to be like her sister Mary. And she steadfastly said, no, indeed, she said. She said, of course, in the first place, he had to win her interest because she's so interested in this other duke. She held him off and refused to have anything to do with him for quite a while. She would even hide when he came to the house and not come to the dinners. They say she wasn't well or something. But eventually, when he got to where he was with her a good bit and he was urging her to become his mistress, she said, absolutely not. She said, the only way I would consider any such relationship with you is that I be your wife. And so, for more than 6 years, Henry kept after. And more than 6 years, he was struggling, trying to get it made so that he said to her, I consider myself a bachelor. I've never been married to Catherine, he said. It's unscriptural. It's wrong for a man to marry his brother's wife. I've never been married to her. I'm a bachelor. There's no reason we shouldn't marry. Well, she said, you tell me that, but she said, She said if that's officially decided by those that have authority, that's one thing. But she said as long as the nation considers her your wife, she said, I'm not certainly not going to be in the position of considering myself your wife. So Henry got more and more impatient. And number five is the Reformation Parliament. The Reformation Parliament. Now, on November 3rd, 1529, a parliament met, which has come to be called the Reformation Parliament. This parliament continued for 7 years. Yes? 1529. Now, this parliament continued for 7 years. And the parliament did what the king wanted. But it's quite evident that it was what the parliament wanted. They probably went quite beyond what the king had in mind at all. But the parliament proceeded to vote that the king was the head of the English church. Well, all English kings had declared themselves to be heads of the church. They had always said a pope has no right to put a man in as a church leader in England without my approval. There'd been a jockeying back and forth as to who had the real power. But the king was the head in one way. In doctrine, they had always felt the pope was the head. Now, the parliament said the king is the head of the church, and he has the right to control the church. And then the king found an old edict made a century and a half ago, which ordered that anyone who would send an appeal to any foreign ruler against the courts of England or the King of England should pay a great fine. And this had been pretty well forgotten, though it was still on the statute book. So under this law, the king brought charges against the whole Church of England because they had recognized the Pope, a foreigner, as head and having authority beyond that of the king. And the church was fined. $500,000, which every one of the ecclesiastical leaders had to pay his sheriff for this. Thus, in pseudo-legal means, they proceeded step by step to break the relationship with the Pope. The Bishop of Rochester, Bishop Fisher, who had been one of the king's good friends, refused to take the oath of supremacy, saying the king was head of the church. And when he refused, the king had him put in prison, but the pope made him a cardinal. And when the king got word the pope had made Fisher a cardinal, the king said, well, I'll send his head to Rome to get the red hat. So he had his head cut off. And one figure that I heard about 2 years ago, someone told me, of seeing a moving picture based on the life of one of Henry's closest friends, named Moore, M-O-R-E, and Thomas Moore. And this man was tremendously interested in this picture, seeing what a great saint Thomas Moore had been and how he suffered for his faith. Well, now that's not quite the exact situation. But Thomas Moore is a man who has been greatly idolized for a number of reasons, and he was killed about the same time Fisher was. So we should say, he's not particularly important in the developing events, but you often hear references to Thomas Moore, so we should say a little about him. Thomas Moore had been a good friend of Erasmus. He was an Englishman, a scholar, a student. He wrote a book called Utopia, which is often referred to today. The word Utopia comes from the name of his book, in which he described an imaginary land in which everything was different from what it was in England then. And they had complete tolerance and freedom of ideas. They had a religion, which he described, which was definitely not Christianity. It was quite different from Christianity. Of course, this is just his imagination of a perfect land. But when a man imagines that about the religion of his perfect land, it makes one wonder as to the depth of his interest in Christianity. But Thomas More was made head of the English government by the king, who was his close friend, and he occupied that position for a time, and when Tyndale's writings would come into England, Moore would do everything he could to stop them, and he would write in very strong language against Tyndale. And Moore had the people with Protestant ideas seized and burned at the stake. He said, "Heretics as they be, the clergy doth denounce them, and as they be well worthy, the temporality doth burn them, and after the fire of Smithfield, hell doth receive them, where the wretches burn forever." That was Moore's attitude toward Protestantism. But as he saw the king's attitude toward the Pope, he began to turn against the king. And he opposed the marriage with Anne Boleyn and refused to take the oath of supremacy. And for this, he resigned his office as head of the government under the king. He was put in prison. And then they say during his last days, his behavior was perfect. And on the scaffold, he spent his time in severe self-discipline. He uttered eloquent words of forgiveness of his enemies, messages of love to the daughter whom he tenderly loved, and brave jests. But he was beheaded, and some tried to make a great saint out of him today. Yes? I don't recall. I couldn't say. That may have been done with someone. I don't know at the time. I know that was done in the next two reigns later with some people. But they were people who had led revolts against the king. I question that about him. Yes. He was ready, as they all were, to concede to the king absolute supremacy in all political and temporal matters. But this oath said that he recognized him as the head of the church against whom there was no appeal. And that's what a few of the clergy refused to take, but most of the clergy took. Bishop Fisher didn't, and Thomas More refused too. Well, the Reformation Parliament did many things, a lot of them under the king's desire, but the most important thing, really, that they did, of course, was to make it possible for people to get copies of the Bible. And the king hated Tyndale, had no use for Tyndale at all, but Cranmer got Tyndale's Bible, of which they didn't yet have the last third, that is, the last third of the old, half of the Old Testament. They took the other parts, they got another man to translate those parts, and then they put a fake name on it, and they said, "Here's a good Bible translated by a man named Matthew," who was purely fictitious. And they said that this would be good to have people read, and Henry gave his approval and put his name to it. And so, though he hated Tyndale, Tyndale's Bible received recognition and began to be distributed in England under another name. And eventually, of course, the other parts that Tyndale translated before his death were joined with it. But at this time, the other half, a third of the whole Bible, was translated by a different man who also was an excellent translator. But we look further at that later. Number six, Henry's marriages to Anne Boleyn and Jane Seymour. Eventually, Henry married Anne Boleyn. Now, there are various ideas as to Anne Boleyn's character. There are those who have tried to make her out as a great Protestant heroine. There are those who make her out as a terribly wicked woman. The probabilities are in between these somewhere. There's no question that she favored the Protestants and that she gave them considerable help. And many of the charges made against her were doubtless made by those who had ulterior motives for criticizing her. But at any rate, Henry married her, and she had a child born, and to his disappointment, it was another girl. And so they named this little girl Elizabeth. And Cranmer was made Archbishop of Canterbury. Cranmer had given his official word that the marriage was annulled, Henry's marriage to Catherine, but that Mary was not illegitimate because the parents had thought themselves married. And so the daughter Mary was in line. She was a legitimate daughter, but now he was married to Anne Boleyn, according to the decision of the Archbishop of Canterbury, and the daughter Elizabeth was born. And then the next year, they had a she had a miscarriage something happened that she thought Henry was hurt, very upset, and she had a miscarriage. And 2 more years went by, and she didn't have a son. And by this time, Henry was good and tired of her anyway. He thought, what on earth did I wait 6 years for her for? And he saw one of her ladies-in-waiting, who had been a close friend of hers named Jane Seymour. And the terrible charges were brought against Anne Boleyn, that she had had adultery with 5 people, including her own brother. And she was therefore, they were tortured and executed, and she was accused of high treason and was beheaded. And even the people who don't like her feel that the charges were so extreme that they probably were put up job altogether. There's a book, I see our time, I shouldn't keep you any longer today. We'll continue here tomorrow.